Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You may have seen it yourself in the years since the Great Recession. Big money investors buying up neighborhoods in American cities. Blocks of homes turned into rentals. Investors jacking up the rent, pushing some out. Rent so high, people can't save up for a down payment. And even people with the means to purchase a home, maybe not finding any for sale. What does it mean when the real estate industry is booming, but home ownership is at a 50-year low? This hour On Point, big buyers and the real estate landscape. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you experienced this in your neighborhood? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we will look at those widely promoted reverse mortgages and how they're working out. But first, big money and real estate. Joining me now in the studio is Dustin Dwyer. He's a reporter for Michigan Radio. Followed this trend in a big audio documentary focused on Grand Rapids called Pushed Out. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. He's currently on leave from Michigan Radio, completing a Nieman Fellowship for Journalists at Harvard. Dustin Dwyer, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks, Tom.
So a few years back, I think maybe half a dozen years back now, five or six, we talked to big investors who were private equity buying up tens of thousands of homes at that time. This was just one firm around the country with plans to rent them out, and these were mainly homes that had gone into foreclosure, rent them out until the market turned around and then sell. Now, I had kind of imagined that maybe that cycle was over, but you've been looking at what continues to go on in Grand Rapids, and I wish you'd give us a flavor for what is happening with investment money, home ownership, and neighborhoods in with respect to kind of in size-wise, sort of second-tier cities like Grand Rapids. Now, what's going on, Dustin?
Yeah, so I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which, as you said, is not one of the biggest cities in America. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a mid-sized city. The population within the city limits is about 200,000 people. Mm-hmm. The metro area is about 1 million people. It's Michigan's second largest city. A lot of people have never even heard of Grand Rapids. But we started hearing just a few years ago about a lot of investors being interested in buying up homes in Grand Rapids, which I found surprising because, you know, I'm not originally from Grand Rapids. And I thought, why would someone from Chicago or California be interested in buying homes in Grand Rapids, Michigan? Mm-hmm. And what we heard more and more from people who were living in Grand Rapids, Michigan, is that these buyers were coming in from elsewhere and buying up these homes, like you said, as investments, and then raising the rents on people who had been living there and forcing many people out. And what I learned after talking to analysts and experts who look at the housing market was just what you said, that there was an initial trend of investors, big hedge funds, buying up lots and lots of properties after the housing crash. Many of them in bigger cities that we think of when we think of mm-hmm. tight housing markets, mm-hmm. San Francisco or New York. And they drove up prices in those cities. And as one analyst put it to me, those cities are now played out. And the investors who have developed this investment strategy are now looking to play it out in other places, places like Grand Rapids, Michigan.
What does play it out mean? Do you have to buy a lot of properties for it to play out in the way that they're hoping as investors?
Well, what I learned is that there's different kinds of players in this market. What happened after the housing crash in 2008, 2009 is that a whole new industry sprung up around property management and allowing single family homes to be handled really as commodities. That if a big hedge fund, say from New York, bought up 1,000 properties or many thousands of properties across the country, mm-hmm. In the past, it was not easy for, say, a big company to buy.
What were they going to do with all that when the toilet needed fixing or the gutter, the downspout fell out?
Exactly. But in local areas, these property management companies started springing up, and they could handle hundreds of investments at a time, and there were now more and more property management companies. And so when that industry sprung up, it allowed these houses to be treated more like investments. And so someone could stand back.
Even on a large scale, at a big volume.
A very large scale. But also, even at a small scale, another thing that has happened is companies have popped up, investment companies, that target individual investors who want to be landlords, but
But don't want to get the toolbox out.
Exactly. Exactly. You can even convert your retirement account now to be just a single family home and treat it in exactly the same way. So you can log on to a website, you can fill in your information, give some of your financial information, and another company will totally handle buying a home for you, managing that home, and you'll just get a residual check in your account. So there, it's possible now for individuals to do this from a distance, and it is possible for these big institutions to do it hundreds and hundreds of homes.
This means less local, you know, block by block neighborhood home ownership, I guess by definition.
Yes, absolutely. And that's what we're seeing in Grand Rapids and in many other cities.
What is the effect of this, first on rentals, second on home prices? And we'll go beyond that, but those, just those two.
So what we find in Grand Rapids, and this is how I originally started looking at this, in Grand Rapids, like I said, it's not a big city. We heard more and more people sort of anecdotally saying they couldn't afford the rent. They were being forced out. And so when we started looking at it, we asked who was buying these homes, who was doing this. And so we did a lot of research on it. I worked with a data journalist, Kay LaFond, at Michigan Radio, and she put together a lot of numbers. One thing that we found is we traced every single foreclosure in the city of Grand Rapids from 2008 to 2016 and looked at who owned them now, what the sort of property class was in the tax rolls. 45% of the homes in the city of Grand Rapids that were foreclosures are now investor-owned, or were investor-owned as of April this year when we did our story.
45%
of all of those foreclosures. City as a whole, it's 24% of all. And this is just single-family homes. Quarter of the city is now owned by investors.
Both of those numbers are astounding.
I mean, it was astounding. And I was expecting the number to be higher. It was astounding when we found that out. When Kay brought those numbers back, we checked and triple-checked. It's really astounding. And what's even more astounding, because that's limited just to single-family homes. We're not talking about apartment buildings.
No, we're used to this in apartment holdings. I mean, those have always been primarily developer-owned and investor-financed.
But so what happens is the people who are owning these homes, they are looking to make money, and they have targets that they want to reach. And it's raising the rents, and more, it's pushing people out of the city of Grand Rapids, and it's happening in many, many cities. And I think to bring it back what we were talking about before, I think we're used to talking about these things when it comes to New York or San Francisco. Mm-hmm. But I'm telling you right now, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, people cannot afford to live. People with jobs, with incomes, cannot find homes to live in.
What's happened with rentals?
Rentals specifically, the rental prices rental rates have gone up. I checked the numbers. There's a website called Zillow where a lot of people search for rentals. Zillow keeps data. As of this spring, certain neighborhoods in Grand Rapids, rents had gone up by as much as 20% in some parts of the city. On average, it's up maybe 10%
year over year.
Yep.
And is it clear that this is in part, I mean, rents go up over time. Is that pace of increase about investors looking to maximize their return?
I think there's a strong case that that's exactly what it is, because when you talk to individuals, which I did, you know, spent time walking around the city, talking to people, you hear the story over and over again. I was living in this house. I had a 3-bedroom house. The landlord I had, who had been my long-term landlord, sold the property to some investor. The investor came in, put in new paint, maybe fixed the drywall, put in new carpet, raised the rent $400 on me, $400 per month, all in one swoop, and said, you can either pay the new rent or you can get out. In many cases, actually, they didn't put a new coat of paint on. Mm-hmm. The owner just came in and said, hey, your rent is now 30% more than what it was last week. And people just move on.
Look at Carolyn calling from Port Richey, Florida. Carolyn, you're on the air with Dustin Dwyer. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I live in one of those neighborhoods in Port Richey, Florida, where several companies own different homes on my block, and the rents are too high. They've raised the rents, and therefore the tenants have to move, young families. And what's even worse is that they're not maintaining the homes. They're not keeping them painted. They're not cutting the lawns. They're letting them run down, which ultimately winds up to the whole market value of the neighborhood running down because nobody wants to live next to a home that's not taken care of.
We've got it. Carolyn, I appreciate your point. Dustin, there's sort of, you know, hey, it's happening in her block.
Sounds very familiar.
If they're not taking care of the homes, how can they raise the rent and get away with it? How does the market bear that?
Well,
I mean, people have to leave. Why didn't the previous owner? It wasn't a renter. It wasn't a rental before. It was probably a, It was a family-owned house.
Exactly. You answered the question. More people are being pushed into the rental market. And in certain cities, I imagine this is the case in Port Richey. It's certainly the case in Grand Rapids, that populations are increasing, mm-hmm. particularly inside the cities. We know there's a trend toward people moving into cities and sort of the urbanization. Mm-hmm. And so there's more and more demand. So these the landlords, they can get the rents.
And what does it do to the overall price profile for homes in a city like Grand Rapids, where this happens, where you've got such a big influx of investment money into single-family homes and beyond apartments? What happens to the price of homes?
They go up. In Grand Rapids, home prices over the last year were year over year up about 11% within the city limits. That, again, is according to the Zillow numbers. And that makes it harder and harder for people to buy homes. So the rental market affects the buyer market mm-hmm, and vice mm-hmm, versa. Mm-hmm. A colleague of mine, actually, another reporter at Michigan Radio, she changed roles at the station last year. She had mm-hmm. lived in Grand Rapids. She mm-hmm. had to move. Mm-hmm. She sold her home. She got 50 offers on her home when she went to sell it.
Because inventory is so scarce now?
So scarce. Yeah, exactly. There's so many people looking for homes, and there's not enough homes out there for people to buy, particularly in the city, in certain neighborhoods. And so it's just fierce competition. I talked to one real estate agent who said the last five homes he sold them all in one day. He said, when you go to list a home for sale, you better be at your computer. You better have your phone on and be at your computer, because you'll immediately get phone calls and you'll sell it that
day. What's the investor's play here? A long-term rental property and just keep those rents to, you know, the maximum the market will bear, or wait for the market to turn up and sell, or whatever optimizes, I guess?
Maybe. I think it can change day by day. We profiled one investment company that's based in Chicago. It's an investment firm called Residential Dynamics Group. In the past few years, they bought up over 100 homes just in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Their website says they bought over 1,200 homes in the Midwest region.
Okay.
And for a while, they were holding those homes. They had property managers handling them, and they were collecting rents. And so they were getting a steady return on them. But when the market to sell the homes goes up, they can dump them. And that's what they did this spring. Right after our story came out, they sold, they moved to sell 177 homes in West Michigan in one sale.
Just to another investor.
They aimed to send it to investor, but a local nonprofit in Grand Rapids got wind of it and is now working to close the deal to buy up those homes. So the nonprofit is trying to get those homes now.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big investment money move into American neighborhood home ownership and how it's changing the face of those neighborhoods and the American real estate market and rents. Dustin Dwyer is with us from Michigan Radio. He came out with a big documentary there, Pushed Out, about the amount of investment money coming into the residential home market in Grand Rapids. That is not the only place where this is playing out. You can join us this hour if you've seen this in your neighborhood, mega investment money or private equity or otherwise, scooping up homes, turning them into rentals, reshaping the market. Has it kept you out of those neighborhoods? Did you see a first wave of this in the recession when Wall Street scooped up foreclosures? How did that work out for rents, for home ownership, for the health of your community if you saw it? Dustin's been out working on this. He talked with Darren Bloomquist at Adam Data, if that's Solutions, if that's how you pronounce it, a company that tracks and analyzes public real estate data nationwide. And he talked about the trend of investors buying up neighborhood homes around the country. According to a report his firm put out this past March, about a third of all homes went to investors in 2016.
Actually, it's slightly over a third, 35% of homes. And this is just single-family homes and condos. We're not talking about apartments or that sort of property that would inherently be an investor property.
We're not talking about apartments. We're talking about single-family homes. Of course, there's always been some of this, but this is kind of next level. Its impact for renters can be pretty tough. Here's from Michigan Radio's broadcast, Jessica Snell, talking about what she's seen in rents.
I went from being pregnant with her, paying $525 a month, till now we're 13 years later and I pay $1,000 a month. So it's like a big jump, especially when you're a single mom.
And here's Van Lee, one of over 100 homeowners in Grand Rapids, whose foreclosed home was bought up by the Chicago firm Residential Dynamics Group. Tried to negotiate them to pay rent for just a month while he tried to find his family a new place to live. No thanks, they said.
That company, you know, business is business. They want their property. You know what I mean? Like you said, he losing money with us staying there. I ain't really too mad at him because, you know, they ain't running a business, you know, and we holding them up.
They're running a business, and we're holding them up. Deanna's calling from Largo, Florida. Deanna, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom and Dustin. I live in Pinellas County, Florida, and so we're on a peninsula.
Yep.
And I have 6 kids. And my kids cannot afford to rent a home in the city that they were born and raised in. They have got to have double jobs, 2 or 3 roommates. My neighbors, I didn't realize that they could have been investors as they got foreclosed on. And again, like a gentleman next door to me got foreclosed and he was couldn't afford to pay the $500 mortgage. And the investor says, well, you can stay and pay $1,200 a month. So our rents have tripled.
Wow.
And whether they're all investors or they're just people who are getting on board who have rental property.
Yep.
But in Pinellas County, Florida, you cannot afford to live here. Well, let's just say middle class and lower income people are definitely feeling the punch. And what is ending up happening is they're getting evicted. So they'll scrounge up the money to get in, and then they can't afford to pay the rent, and they get evicted. And it's a constant horrible, horrible.
Deanna, how do you feel about it? I mean, we live in a market economy, you know. What the market bears is what people pay. And there you are in the teeth of that. How do you feel about it?
I feel like I don't know how they got rent control in New York, but we need it. We need it. It's ludicrous that you have got to work a couple of jobs just to pay your rent, and you cannot. There's no way that you can afford rental insurance, and you have to choose and eating beans and macaroni and cheese if you can even afford that. I mean, there's something wrong in the best country in the world that there's no. You can't afford to have a comfortable roof over your head.
Deanna, I got more callers here, but I hear you loud and clear, and I really appreciate your call. Thank you for it. I want to get one more right here, if I may, from Madison, Alabama. Thank you, Deanna. Rory, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's happening everywhere. I mean, in San Antonio, I'm a pretty handy guy, and
okay.
I find homes in the past, fix them up, and turn them into rental property.
Okay.
I haven't been able to do that in the past 4 years just because of the big companies coming in and buying them up.
Big companies coming in.
So what it's done is... Go ahead.
Big companies coming in, you're saying, and buying them up. Got it. Yeah. So?
Yeah, investment companies.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that done is raised the home prices so much because they'll just come in and pay the asking price. It's raised the rate so much that the city of San Antonio has increased the taxes on these properties 42% in the last 4 years. So that makes it so we have to keep raising the rents just to pay the taxes. Because the prices are being inflated by these big companies.
So you get into a spiral there, and you're out of the game at this point, Rory, because the big investors have come in kind of over the top of you, I guess.
That's correct. And, you just keep raising rates, and you feel bad for the people because you can't make affordable housing. You'd like to, but it's just a big bubble, I think there.
Rory, I really appreciate your call and wish you luck with your investments there. Dustin, what's the net effect here on communities? I mean, people may look at this and say, well, someone's going to own the houses. Someone's going to live in them. How does it matter if it's a smaller investor like Rory or a bigger investor, if it's large scale or smaller scale?
Well, there's a sort of feeling that, it's sort of the house always wins kind of a thing. You know,
as in the casino.
Yeah. So the big companies always win. So when the real estate crisis happened, that fell most on individuals, these low income, middle income people.
Mm-hmm.
There was a racial breakdown, certainly.
Yes.
Affected black and Hispanic homeowners, more than whites. And now, there would be, you know, if we were sitting here 8 years ago, mm-hmm. there'd be in some sense people cheering that houses were selling for so much, that the housing market had roared back so much. None of us really even expected it to come back this quickly and mm-hmm. this well. Mm-hmm. But who's winning? It's these big companies. And as Rory was talking, it was reminding me that one of the things that's happening in Grand Rapids and in many other cities is that the housing prices are rising so fast that the appraisals, the houses can't be appraised for the full value that people are being willing to pay for it, which means it gets a little complicated, but it means you can't get a mortgage for the full amount that the house is going to go for. So what that means is you can get a mortgage, say, for $140,000. If the house is going to sell at $180,000, if there's offers at $180,000, mm-hmm. the difference has to be made up in cash. And so what that means is if I'm just a regular home buyer, I've got a mortgage for $140,000, the house is going to sell at $180,000, I need $40,000 cash.
And you're not going to have it. And so it's going to go to some investor who turns it into a rental property or buys up more of that block.
Exactly.
And we don't have the traditional pattern of community home ownership. It's a lot to think about here. Dustin Dwyer with Michigan Radio. Please stand by. Susan Wachter joins us right now from Philadelphia, professor of real estate and finance at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Co-director there of the Institute of Urban Research. Susan Wachter, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
We've been hearing about this for years. What do you see going on big scale? Is it changing the profile of home ownership in this country? That was kind of related to identity and to, you know, people's way into the equity economy.
Yes, it has changed. It's an historic shift. We see a increase in households of approximately 9 million since 2004, and they are all rental households. They are all renters.
Okay, so we're not the same kind of nation of small landowners then. We're renters. I mean, it sounds kind of like heading back to serfdom. That's putting too big a word on it, but this was people's little piece of the pie, Susan.
Yes, well, we still have, although we're testing 50-year lows, a home ownership rate is now at 63.7, which is actually a bit off the bottom, which was last year at 62.9. Okay. But still, that's at historic lows. And the problem is likely to get worse before it gets better because of the overall demographics. So we're in the medium-term future. This is not going to go away just by itself. The problems are too fundamental to the market. Grand Rapids sounds like it's on the cusp of this and is kind of an epicenter, if you will, but it's happening across the country as not just the big cities now, second-tier cities, third-tier cities. Two major trends, movement back to the cities where the jobs are and the movement back by people who can afford to rent but they cannot afford to own. Young millennials who need to be there for the jobs, who want the jobs, and they're pushing others, single-family homeowners, out into perhaps less expensive suburban. And that's why poverty is actually growing in the suburbs.
How does it change the character of a community when it's less individually and locally owned, Susan?
Well, that's an interesting question. These houses are being occupied, so it's not that they're being blighted. And that,
yeah, but they're not. It's not owner occupancy in the same way.
Not owner occupancy, and that's a major issue for neighborhoods, major issue for America. It's a major issue for households who are young, who wish to get on the homeownership ladder so that they can afford to stay. Because it's not just that your rent is unaffordable day one, but that rents continue to go up perhaps faster than your wage.
Dustin, I mean, traditionally, you know, you'd look down the block and you would sort of presume, well, we each own our home here, so we have that kind of stake in it. What's your sense of how it changes the character of a community or neighborhood when you've got so much investor money? So maybe half the homes on the block or, you know, a third or a 40%, whatever, are owned by somebody who's, I don't know, in Chicago, New York, you name it.
You know, it's not just people who owned their own homes. You could look down the whole block and say there were long-term landlords there, where the individual who had been renting there for many, many years, they knew the landlord. The landlord even was a part of the community. Mm-hmm. And even if there were, you know, there's some landlords weren't always great.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They knew their landlord, and they had been there a long time. What's happening now is that because it's being treated as a commodity, it's just flipping over and over and over. And, you know, 1 year someone will be here, and the next year whoever shows up, they're the ones who are going to be here. And as Professor Wachter pointed out, that young people are moving into certain neighborhoods, and a lot of times you see families being pushed out, families with children, families, single moms. They can't afford to live in these places anymore. The millennials are showing up with the, you know, in Grand Rapids, there's lots of new jobs at the hospital, there's lots of nursing jobs, and people are coming in to fill up those homes, and it's pushing other people out.
Well, yeah. Joel in Charlotte, North Carolina. Joel, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I live here in the Carolinas. It's happening all over the place based on the phone calls I'm hearing and what I'm seeing here in the Charlotte area. But my question or point is, I'm not sure if it's chicken and the egg or cause and effect, but it seems like this is the cause and the effect of the wealth disparity we're experiencing in our country. And furthermore, haven't we all seen this play out at family night, play Monopoly for 50 years now? Eventually, one guy ends up with all the properties and can do whatever he wants. I don't know. It just seems like that's the way the country's headed in terms of the finances in the real estate market.
A Monopoly game, maybe right there on the block where we live, those little houses, yours and mine. Joel, I appreciate your call from Charlotte. Susan Wachter, do you relate this to the wealth disparity, the income inequality and wealth disparity the country is famously in the midst of?
Yes, and it is both cause and effect. The effect part of it is that if you're a renter, it's difficult to save for the down payment for a home, and most millennials aspire to be homeowners. That hasn't changed, despite what some people think. Actually, aspirationally, most families want to become homeowners as they proceed, have children, et cetera. So that hasn't changed, but the ability to do so, the ability to get a mortgage, it's more difficult today than it was 15 years ago. We're not talking, obviously, about the blowout period when
mm-hmm.
far too easy, but we have boomerang to find it very difficult. Unless you have pristine credit, it's hard. And as housing prices go up, it gets harder. And as rents go up, it gets harder to save. So it's kind of a discouraged renter effect that's adding to this. And of course, we know that home ownership is the way to build wealth. That's the way to save. So hopefully you pay off your mortgage, retirement, you're safe. That's the concern, that we may see a new generation who are never owners, who are ever renters, and who are not able to build that wealth.
You know, when we first talked with investors about this half a dozen years ago, they were saying, well, we're coming in, we're going to buy here, you know, we have the cash and we can scoop up thousands of homes, this firm was talking about. And then when the market comes back, we'll sell those, we'll make a tidy sum, we'll rent in the meantime. Is it possible that this all just turns back the other way, Susan? Or do we have something long-term here where a higher percentage of Americans are renters long-term and kind of locked out of the piece of the equity game?
The trends we see is that it is long-term, and it's not necessarily the same in large-scale investors, private equity investors. In fact, it's the majority of rental households are still the far majority, 85% of rental properties are owned by those who own 10 or less. But what's happened, and it's a major shift, is that single-family detached homes have shifted from ownership to rental. And that's not just the 1,000 homes owned by perhaps a private equity firm. It's the hundreds of homes or tens of homes. And there it is consistent with what was being discussed by Dustin before about management companies who are coming in and making it easier. But they're going in that direction because the demand is there. The demand is there because home ownership is not affordable. Rent is affordable. Where the jobs are, that's where the millennials want to go.
Dustin Dwyer, you spend a lot of time talking with people in Grand Rapids about this. How do people think about what it means for their city long-term and their neighborhoods to have this much bigger, big money presence of investors owning single-family homes?
Well, it's a problem.
Why?
Because as you said, there's less local accountability, and that's a problem in the city. You know, the political apparatus in the city commission is trying to preserve some local presence, some local control. They need to respond to local residents. These investors coming in from Chicago or wherever, they're not necessarily accountable to this area. They don't necessarily have an investment, a long-term investment idea for how to build Grand Rapids as a city. But it's a challenge for a town like Grand Rapids or any town to try to meet this because, as you said, this is market-driven. And the market will set the price at whatever the market will set the price at. So it's, at some level, it's really hard for a city to keep up, say, by building more affordable housing, or by creating housing policies that will keep more people in their homes and keep people from being pushed out of the city. And what I came down with is that a lot of it ultimately comes down to wages. I mean, none of this would be a problem, say, if rents went up 20% in a year. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be a problem if wages went up 20% in a year. But the wage growth is not keeping up with the rental growth, and that's an issue that needs to be talked about as well, I think.
Susan, maybe this just speeds a process that's has been underway for a while.
It's not been underway for that long, actually. We had the, of course, Great Recession, which was an altogether different direction. This movement back to the city is the last, I would say, 10, 15 years, but it's accelerating. It's not slowing down.
And with big investors at the heart of so many of these purchases, changing the ownership pattern on blocks of single-family homes. And the landlord, the face of the landlord is just, I guess, Dustin, maybe that, you know, it's the bill in the mail and an 800 number.
And that's what we're seeing in Grand Rapids, yep.
Dustin Dwyer is with Michigan Radio. He's a Nieman Fellow at Harvard this year. His big documentary on this is called Pushed Out, a documentary on housing in Grand Rapids. You can link to it at our website. Dustin, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And Susan Wachter at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. Thank you very much for joining us, Susan.
My pleasure.
When we return, we're going to look at reverse mortgages. You've heard them advertised. How do those work out? This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. For cash-strapped seniors, the promise can seem particularly sweet. Turn home equity into spendable cash. But reverse mortgages have left some older Americans facing foreclosure. Homes they've lived in for 30, 40, 50 years at risk. We want to look at that. You can join us. Have you taken out a reverse mortgage? How has that worked out for you? They advertise heavily, and we've all heard it over the years. Here's one you've probably seen sooner or later. Former U.S. Republican senator from Tennessee, presidential hopeful at one time, Fred Thompson, in a commercial for reverse mortgage.
Hi, I'm Fred Thompson. And you know, if you're like a lot of folks out there lately, then finances might be a little tight. Well, maybe it doesn't have to be that way. Because if you're 62 years or older and own your own home, then join hundreds of thousands of other Americans who have used a reverse mortgage as a safe, effective financial tool.
Hey, these ads all over the place. Here's actor Henry Winkler. Same theme. Here you go.
Hi, I'm Henry Winkler, and I'm here to tell homeowners that are 62 and older about a great way to live a better retirement. It's called a reverse mortgage.
Gosh, it's great. It's fantastic. Here's actor Tom Selleck selling.
I know what you're thinking. I thought what you thought. Some things are just too good to be true.
Okay, what about it? Joining me now is Jennifer McKim, senior investigative reporter for the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. She's been covering the way reverse mortgages put some seniors at risk for foreclosure. Jennifer, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
So we see these ads all over the place. They wouldn't be there if they weren't putting out a lot of these mortgages. I mean, these must have pretty wide use. I've never really looked into them, but a lot of people must take them.
Well, exactly. There is a large problem among seniors who've ended up putting money into their homes for decades, but finding themselves with no cash to spend on other expenses. So they decide, they see these great ads on television that this is going to answer all their problems, and they grab them.
How does a reverse mortgage work?
It's so complicated, and I think that's one of the problems. But basically, in general, unlike a traditional forward mortgage where you're borrowing money from a lender to buy your home, this is instead you're borrowing equity from the house that you've built up over years that you mm-hmm. have to pay later, either when you die, move out, or fail to meet some of the requirements of the loan.
So give me an example. Let's say I've got a house and it's now worth $200,000 and I need some cash.
So you're 62 years or older. Okay. You can qualify for one of these loans. Now, unlike a couple of years ago, they're going to do a financial assessment to see if you can afford it. But before, it was like back in the old days, if you could fog a mirror you could get one of these loans.
Fog a mirror, you can get the loan.
And basically, you can get about, depending on your age, about half of the equity of your home. You can either get it in a lump sum, mm-hmm. a home equity loan, or monthly installments. So for cash-strapped seniors, it can be a real answer to people who maybe even they have a little bit of mortgage they want to pay off. They can mm-hmm. take the equity out, pay the mortgage off, and have a little cash extra.
But then I'm going to have less equity in that home unless I've paid it off. But I mean, when you get the reverse mortgage, at some point they want.
Yeah, the idea is basically these are for people who want to age in place. These are people who maybe don't have heirs and maybe just don't mind not having equity at the end when they die.
Yeah.
So basically at the end, if you die or move out, there's an accounting of how much money you've taken out of your home. And it builds up pretty quickly because it interests, fees, et cetera, that you might borrow 50% of your home's equity and by the end there's nothing left.
So you're saying for some people this works out well. They need the cash. This is a way to have it. They don't mind if they don't leave a home to somebody later.
Yep. I've heard from some people, from some of my stories, who say this was a godsend. I could have not lived in my home any other way, and I needed this to be able to stay here. And that was why the U.S. HUD decided to give this program, because there were people who needed it, and they believe in it, and that's why it's being funded partly by taxpayers. It's insured by the government.
Oh, I didn't realize that. All right. So there's a kind of a subsidy here as well. So when it goes well, great. You've also looked at circumstances in which it does not. What have you found?
Correct. So the thing is that when you heard all those ads from Tom Selleck and Fred Thompson, they used to sell it as no risk. You'll still own your home. This is a great option. But the problem is that some elders and advocates say they misunderstood this to think that they had no monthly payments at all. But still, indeed, they did have to pay property taxes and insurance and maintain their homes and things. And years later, they realized that they weren't paying these things. And then they were getting foreclosure notices. So people who thought that they could die in their homes, 90-year-old people, suddenly being told that they had to leave because they owed as little as a couple $100 in taxes that they hadn't paid, and the lender paid, and then this whole foreclosure process happened. And really, people have heard this over and over around the country, that more and more people like this are calling confused that they're poised to lose their properties.
How does it happen that they don't know what they're signing up for here? I mean,
well, exactly. I mean, a lot of people say, of course, you know that you should pay your taxes and insurance. But as we all know, a lot of people during the housing crisis signed documents that maybe they didn't completely understand. And a lot of these elders had already paid off their mortgages or had been paying mortgages where it was paid in escrow. So when it came then, they said they didn't know. Others just said, you know what, they got lump sums at the beginning and they didn't have any money left. And at that point, they weren't doing any type of financial assessments. HUD, realizing this was a problem in 2015, implemented new financial assessments so that now they look at you and say, can you afford to pay the taxes and insurance over time so we don't end up with this problem? But there's a huge problem from the people before then, this sort of looming crisis of elderly people who bought the properties before these changes.
So HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Department, is actually screening every American application for a reverse mortgage now to see whether you can afford to go down this path or not?
Well, they set the regulations. They insure them, and they implement all these rules that they give to the originators and the lenders about what to do with these loans. And this was one of the things they changed because they saw this growth in foreclosures among old people, which nobody really – it looks terrible for everybody when you're foreclosing on grandma.
Give us a story that may help us understand how this has played out when it has not played out well. I'm sure you've spoken with people who found themselves on that path.
Exactly. So I spoke with a woman in Washington, D.C. She's 92 years old. She bought signed up for a reverse mortgage 10 years ago because she needed some money. She refinanced it again, and then she ended up having troubles within her own home with being able to pay off some bills. She had financial issues with some family members, and she ended up having a $6,000 tax and insurance payment that she couldn't pay. And the lender said, we're going to foreclose upon you because you owe this $6,000, even though she signed this deal to hope that she would live there forever. And so it was very stressful. I talked to this woman multiple times. She's 92 years old, lived there forever. Her church is nearby, and facing foreclosure for her was just the scariest thing she could possibly think about.
I mean, if you get into that situation when you're 92 or 82, or you, once you don't have an income that's growing with the rest of the economy, maybe you have a very limited retirement funds, any bill that comes in can be quite a sort of a deal breaker.
Exactly. No, these people, that's the whole reason they got into these loans, is they didn't have money. That's why they they took the equity out of their properties, and then they really have no other options. And so that's the sort of heartbreaking thing, I think, for a lot of housing advocates, people around the country who said they're hearing from more and more spikes in these old people coming in and saying, I don't know what to do. And some of these, some of the servicers of these loans have been known to be more aggressive pushing people out, and that some foreclosure proceedings have started with very little amounts of money owed. So that's the concern.
We've got callers on reverse mortgages from Omaha, Nebraska. Deborah's calling. Hi, Deborah. You're on the air with Jennifer McKim.
Hi, Tom and Jennifer. Thanks so much for taking my call. Long-time listener. We had a very unpleasant experience when my 90-year-old mother-in-law died about 2 years ago. She had a reverse mortgage. She had used about $30,000 on a house that was valued at about $150,000 when she died.
Yep.
And what shocked us was how aggressive Wells Fargo was at trying to get their money. We were getting letters within a week of her death, and pretty much got them weekly or every 2 weeks, even though we have at least 90 and maybe it might have been 180 days to sell the house and settle the loan, which worked out fine. We got it sold in plenty of time, but it was so offensive just how aggressive they were about closing that loan to that $30,000.
So, Deborah, did you see this coming? Did you understand all the way along that when death finally came here, settling all this would mean selling the home? And what surprised you was just how fast they were demanding that it be done?
Yes, we absolutely understood that. She had cancer, and it was rather sudden. She had a cancer surgery, died within 2 weeks. So it wasn't like we had a long time. We weren't anticipating her death at the time by any means. So, yes, it was mostly they were just so heavy-handed about it. We were just really, really irritated.
Yeah, that's not when you want to be dealing with that. And yet the hammer would come down there. Deborah, thanks for your call. Jennifer, that's when you would sort of the rubber meets the road. All right, you took the reverse mortgage. Now, cover it.
I've heard that a lot from people who say things like also that they're seeing real estate agents circling around their house. They're getting all these extra fees, too, for appraisals on their property before they're even, twice and three times a month. So there was actually a suit filed with that because they were saying they were charging these folks, adding more and more cost to their bill by the end of the time.
I mean, the time requirement there, because people are settling estates, it's a time when you're not necessarily in a situation to be really quick.
Exactly. I can't remember exactly what the time period is, but I've definitely heard that there are, again, some lenders who are very aggressive on this, and it can be heartbreaking.
George in Canton, Ohio. George, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a quick question for your panelists.
Mm-hmm.
My situation is that my home had started into the foreclosure process in that the original bank had written it off. I was able to stop that process, though, by catching up with payments.
Good for you.
With help from a relative.
Yeah.
But my question is, does a home like that qualify for this type of mortgage or not?
Well, if you have equity in your property, I think that is the big question. If you have equity in your property and now it is tougher to get these loans than it was before, so they're going to look to see if you can take equity out and still have the money to pay over the time of your expected lifespan to pay your property taxes and insurance.
So it's all about the equity you've got in there. If it's been, teetering on that foreclosure line, I don't know how much is going to be there. I would look very carefully at that, George. We're looking at reverse mortgages, how they work, and for some people, how they bite. What about the volume of these things? After all the advertising that we've seen for this, is this growing in popularity? Is it declining? You say they've become tougher in terms of who they're willing to give these to.
So during the housing boom, reverse mortgages also started to increase, and there was a lot of push among lenders and originators to promote these things. And then they started to drop again over the last couple of years. So the numbers are going down. And there's also been some changes within HUD that looks like it's going to be harder, less money. Elders will be getting less money out of them and maybe paying more in premium. So that was just a change that happened about a month ago, basically because HUD was saying, listen, we're losing money on this program and we can't afford to do it. So now it's questionable. At the same time, there's this huge market of seniors who can't afford to live in their properties.
And desperate to stay there very often, looking
Correct.
For options. Julie in Baltimore. Julie, thank you for calling. You're on with Jennifer McKim.
Yes, thank you.
Hi.
My comment is several years ago, my house was paid off. Several years ago, I looked into a reverse mortgage just to have a little extra money.
Yeah.
And I had got a chart on what the payback would be.
Mm-hmm.
And in less than 5 years, payback for a reverse mortgage would have been double what my house was valued at. And, I mean, there's no way it could have ever been paid because the house wouldn't sell for that.
Wow. Are you following Jennifer?
So are you saying that by within 5 years you would have eaten up all the equity in your property?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is definitely concern among people I've talked to who have gotten these things that have been really surprised at how quickly the debt increases. And closing costs are more expensive than a regular traditional mortgage. And you also have to pay an insurance fee to the federal government to be in the program. So there are a lot of expenses. A lot of times it's for people who just, you know, they're not worried about that because in the end, they're just going to walk away.
I mean, I don't know if you've looked into the finances of this, but Is it a racket? Are the fees and the return that go to the reverse mortgage companies reasonable? Because they've got people who may be desperate here. They're aging. They're desperate to age in place or have somewhere to live. It seems like a situation ripe for exploitation.
Well, there's definitely been a lot of that. And there's been a lot of lawsuits and federal claims, issues that there was lying to elders. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been very involved in the reverse mortgage issue over the last couple of years, basically dinging a bunch of originators for lying, pretty much lying, deceiving elders to think that they would not lose their home. So there's definitely, and there's been people who've promised them things that wouldn't happen. There's also been this issue called widow foreclosures, where spouses will buy, who've lived together forever, decide to only put one of them on this mortgage. And they were encouraged back in the day to put the oldest person on the mortgage because then they would get more equity out of the property because they were older.
Okay.
And then the older person dies, and then the other person would be kicked out of the property. And that caused lawsuits and problems, and HUD has tried to fix the issue with the widows. But there are still problems, and there's still a lot of widows who say, I'm being forced out.
If somebody's out there right now and they've been thinking about doing this because they need the cash, what's your advice on how to step forward with it?
Well,
or to do it at all.
I think the advice is to really research it and really think if it's right for you and see if, it, you know, talk to, there are required counseling with these things now. In Massachusetts, it has to be face-to-face because there are so many people who say they misunderstood it or weren't prepared
with
for
a financial
what happened.
Planner or who's doing this counseling?
Well, there's nonprofit agencies who get on the phone and talk to you to see if it's a right thing for you. Because, again, you have to think that at the end you're really probably not going to have anything left for your heirs, and you should probably talk to them. I think there's.
But if you play it wrong, you may end up without a house for yourself as well, and at an age where that is going to be very, very unsettling.
Well, exactly. But at the same time, there are some people who might, without have taken this money out, might not have been able to stay there anyway.
Yep.
So
yep.
That's sort of the deal they're having to make.
Buyer beware. When it comes to the reverse mortgage front, get some good counseling on your personal financial situation and be fully aware of the costs that are going to come along with this. Jennifer McKim has been looking into it all for the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. She's senior investigative reporter there. Jennifer, thank you very much for coming in and sharing with us today.
Thank you very much.
Jennifer McKim. Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And thanks, as always, for all your contributions to this show. Great to have you with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.